And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms or restrictions apply.
Welcome to Rates and Barrels. It is Friday, February 16th, and it is a live one. Derek Van Riper, Eno Saris, and our newest addition to the Rates and Barrels crew, Trevor May, is here for the first time. Trevor, welcome to Rates and Barrels.
Thanks for having me on, guys. I'm very excited having me on. I guess I'm going to be here quite a few times. So I'm really, really pumped for this. Thanks for inviting me.
Every Friday, if you're not watching us live today, 1 o'clock Eastern, we can go live on our YouTube channel. It's an amazing transition, right? 450 innings in the big leagues, 520 Ks, 21 saves that many of our listeners are very grateful for as a heavy fantasy baseball podcast. And now you're here. And I started to think about this. You know, we've had this debacle unfolding over the last couple of days since pitchers and catchers have reported to spring training. The uniforms have been an absolute mess. And I know sometimes uniform hijinks happens at some point along the way. If not in the big leagues, maybe on the way to the big leagues. This is an all-timer, though. Steven Nesbitt from The Athletic had a story about this, and he had a quote from Carlos Estevez. It said, "When I wear my pants, I feel like I'm wearing someone else's pants," which just seems like a miserable way to have to try and pitch. It seems like any sort of physical discomfort when you're out there trying to do that job seems incredibly difficult. So I have to ask you, have you ever had to wear someone else's pants during a game?
I have. I actually did a few times with the Mets in 2022 when I wore the pants up. I didn't have pants up, so they had to go into the back and find me. I was like, I want some shorties or some tweeners or the bucks is what I would call them. And they go back and they found some a pair of a guy that a minor league guy had in spring training. They're like, try these on. And they were huge, but I was like, sure. And it was fine. Like, I chose them, but like, they weren't tailored for me. And there's a time in spring where like Majestic is coming now, I believe Nike, right? Yeah. And they come in and say, hey, like, do you need adjustments to your pants? And then you kind of go over them, and then they get you a little bit of a change to your styles. Guys want to go different, or their bodies change or whatever. And usually that takes care of it. But yeah, I it's weird. I'm seeing a lot of stories like this too. Like, guys are like, what happened? Like, what is going on? Why are all these wrong? Like, why don't our pants fit? And it is the worst because it's something you're in. Like, they need to fit like a glove. Like, they got to feel like pajamas almost, like the most comfortable things ever because you're in them all day, every day. So, yeah, that's not a good way you want to start your spring by your uniform not fitting.
Imagine Robbie Ray in some baggy pants, dude. He does need to cinch right into that.
Or God forbid, tighter, you know?
Yeah. Oh my God. Could it get
not
tighter?
Possible. Not possible.
We call those spray-ons. They come in a can. You spray them on.
You know, just from an aesthetic standpoint, I think they look pretty terrible. Like the weird lettering is look at that. I mean, it's tiny lettering.
Oh, bad.
You
that's
know,
the difference? Is that the side-by-side from last year and this year?
Yeah, the Kirby and Gilbert is side-by-side, yeah.
Wow. Look at how bunch they are on the right, too.
The numbers are smaller, the trim's different, the nameplates on the back are smaller, and then, of course, there's all the fabric stuff they're talking about. Yeah, that Mariners image comes from the Bobby Mullins, then I think it's Jeff Jones with the Miles Michaelis jersey, if you're looking at those visuals. I mean, the Cardinals jerseys are kind of boring anyway, but to make them look worse is actually an amazing achievement.
That looks like a jersey, dude.
They look like they're ironed on. Look how crooked the nine is on Michaelis's.
Nine is crooked, too. I didn't know.
What?
That's Fanatics quality right there.
I retired just in time. I think that's confirmation. I was still on the fence. Now I'm certain. Yeah.
Shades of, what was it, Great Britain?
Where
during the WBC, they had like their letters were falling off.
Who was that photo of? Is Worley. Worley's jersey where he's just losing. Yeah. He missed like two letters in Great Britain.
I felt so bad for them. That was like, you know, so the thing that's different about that is like WBC, like you have only as much money as like your country will give you for the WBC. Like it's, they don't have great funding. So just, I actually felt bad for Great Britain because I was like, oh man, you kind of, you're like kind of a small program. Like, yeah, okay. Like I could see how this happened, but you know, all of the MLB like spring training is not a small program. That should be, you should dedicate your best resources to it. So to look like the same as Great Britain's ironed on jerseys is a fail, really.
Yeah, not a W for sure.
It's not what you're looking for. The other thing that had me kind of thinking from the perspective of someone who's played in the big leagues, what is the worst training idea you've ever acted on? Something you thought was going to help you? Because I saw a story today. Nolan Shanuel decided to stand up all day long, twice a week, throughout the entire offseason. This was his idea. The Angels didn't tell him to do it. This was his way to make his legs stronger in a very literal sense. Sam Blum wrote that one for The Athletic. Did you ever try anything like that? You're like, this might work.
Not like that. That so I pride my ability or my, I pride myself in my ability to like have a reason to back up the thing I'm doing. Like, so I can honestly, like, I wanted to come in. I saw this in the rundown. I wanted to come in and be like, no, everything I did worked perfectly. The standing to make your legs strong. Like I get the, I don't stand up enough. I don't want to be sedentary. You know, I need to, you know, get my feet. Like I literally just saw a video from Mitch Haniger about his like work on making his feet stronger and gripping the ground and grounding, and Ottavino does stuff like that. And so I was like, that's good stuff. But like, it sounds like Nolan was, that's what he's looking for. And he's just not quite there yet. The worst thing I ever did was probably in that vein. And I think I was going to run in like the, you know, the barefoot shoes, and I just did it. And let me tell you, that is not something you just do.
You just have to ramp your way up into that, right?
Yeah, you can't. But, you know, yeah, you're sore. Your feet are sore in a way that you did not know that was possible. There's things moving that haven't moved in your life. And I was like, I'm going to go run 10 poles in basically barefoot. Like, I'm just going to go run 10 miles on the beach. No, you're not. You're not going to do that. Because now you're going to, then you're not going to do it for a month because you're going to be sore for that long. So, that was one, but I had to adjust it quickly. So I'm, we'll just watch Daniel hit 30 homers or something, and then everyone is going to have standing desks next year.
That'll be the new thing.
Yeah.
It's a copycat league.
There's a real backlash against some things that, like, I think have value but do look strange. I can think of certain Twitter accounts that take hitting, some of the hitting training methods to account. Like, there's this, you can hit on, like, a board that moves. And it's to like keep you, to help you be stable, but it looks really funny when you're watching someone do it. It doesn't really look like hitting. So like, what's the weirdest training thing you do that like has legitimate reason but doesn't look like pitching at all? Is there anything you can think of? Is it like the shoulder tube? Like one of the things that's kind of iconic for pitching is like this thing that you hold that you kind of, you're just sitting there like kind of making this board kind of go up and down, you know, the shoulder tube. Do you do anything like that?
The body blade. Yeah. So
the body blade,
something called body blade. It looks like a long piece of like flexible, I think it's metal wrapped in plastic, but like you're trying to get it to wobble up and down. Kind of like a sheet wobbling up and down. It's supposed to stabilize your shoulder, which those are actually really good, and the science supports that because
there's science there. It just doesn't look like pitching.
Yeah, it doesn't look like pitching. But then you go through motions, and you also can like put your finger pressure in to get it to like, you can turn it sideways and like feel that, like, so if you're working on forearm stuff. So there's a bunch of stuff you can do. There's something I had when I was a kid called a Dynaflex, a gyro ball that you spin, and then it like spins in your hand like this, and then you go the other way and you try to build forearm strength.
I remember that. Yeah.
But it's the same thing, same kind of premise, is you can go out and you can like do the same type of movements you do with the body blade. And I hadn't seen one. Like nobody had them because they're kind of like, not that they don't work, they're just kind of older school technology. Right. And of course, I walk into the A's clubhouse and there's two of them. So then I fired it back up and I used it all year and arm felt good.
They're portable. They're way more portable than the blade, right? You know, you can just throw them in the bag.
Kind of passive. You can just sit in your locker just like for a minute each way, and you get your arm warmed up, and it's like kind of feels kind of nice. I liked it, and I used I like to think that that's what made me throw hard as a kid. So I was like, I still have that connection. So I'm like, maybe I'll throw harder. I don't know.
Well, the Body Blade sounds more like capital S science. What Nolan Chanuel had, that was just an idea.
Yeah, was an right. idea. Yeah. What if I?
There's got to be a million stories from around the game of people just trying all sorts of crazy things. We were talking about with sticky stuff a few years ago, the homemade concoctions that pitchers were trying to cook up, like, trying to find something else to get grip. Never ending possibilities.
Hitters have the best stuff, by the way, for that. The hitters, like Noda had the strap on the head and the ball. Did you ever see him doing that, you know, when you were in there? Because he did it right before BP, and he'd like it out, and he'd literally do like the boxing, like short punches, and just keep the ball like a literally one of the ping pong paddle things with the ball, but on his forehead, and he just punched things to try to keep track on the ball. Mauer did some stuff too with like you know the peripheral vision, like lights impressing him, trying to develop.
Hit the
concussion stuff too, so that was part of it. But like, there's a lot of like that kind of stuff that hitters do to like track balls, and it's pretty funny to watch when you don't know what they're doing.
Ping pong ball on the hat? On the hat? He's got a ping pong ball. Like, he's trying to punch a ping pong ball.
Yeah, it's like one of those red rubber balls, and he's just punching it. And it's going back out. And the other guys try it, and no one can touch it. And he's just, like, crushing it because he does it so much.
Well, Noda might have the best eye on the team.
So. He does, exactly. I'm like, maybe everyone should do this and get you one of those.
So this time of year is incredible because there's so much information that comes out. Beat reporters have, I think, a really hard job this time of year. It's a flood of information. They're trying to make sense of it. Only a percentage of it's even true, the stuff they're told, that is. And then we, on the outside, are like, what's really going on? So, an example, Justin Verlander. He said Wednesday. He's a couple weeks behind schedule because his right shoulder didn't bounce back the way he'd hoped during his off-season throwing program. That could mean anything. What are we supposed to do with information like this that just keeps coming out day after day throughout camp now that everything's started up?
Well, this is always a very interesting thing because here's the deal. Offseason, guys, everyone treats their offseason a little differently. Like some guys are super connected with the team still. Like they even stay in this spring training place. They're working out of the stadium. Like they're with the trainers all the time, and that's the best situation for them. But a lot of guys like go home and they're you know, their family's from a place that isn't there, and they don't like the resources they have are limited too. And so things get a little bit like if you're feeling something and you have time because it's still the off season, you tend to kind of wait and see. It's like take a break, see if it's just something small, and then go from there, because the real sense of urgency doesn't start until your spring training, whether you try to get it to or not. Like it just isn't the same thing unless you're there. And so that's what happens a lot. And you know, we mentioned the Bradish thing and the Means thing. There's a bunch of stuff coming out all over the place, even like treatment happening we didn't hear about. Because they're like, maybe this isn't a thing until we have to tell people we're not going to. And so that's why it all happens right now. And for like Justin, you know, he's 40. Like he doesn't know every year now. He's like, let's see what's going to happen here in the offseason. Max Scherzer, very similar. They're both like, let's see. But they've also been around so long enough that they know a lot about themselves. So sometimes they have a hunch. And then they're the ones that are going to make the decision at the end of the day anyways. Like no training staff is going to tell them, you know, what, yeah, what's happening. It's just where they're at in their careers. Hall of Famers. That's just what's going to happen. What they say goes. So some guys like that can handle their own thing. And then he comes in, he's like, hey, I thought it would bounce back. It didn't. We'll just manage it. We'll take it one step at a time. This just happens. And then there's younger guys who are maybe afraid to say something because, you know, maybe they're on the cusp or maybe they want to make a team and they're hoping it goes away. And unfortunately, that doesn't happen all the time. All of these things happen, but they're all happening at the same time. And the guys are having these different reactions that kind of come out in the same news cycle. And it's you know, I've had this happen. I had this happen with my back in 16, coming back in 17, where I was like, this needs to be fixed because I can't have that year again. And then that's when I got Tommy John because I don't think I threw as much long toss as I needed to. So it caused another problem. But I do remember being like, no, I'm good when I'm still kind of worried about it. Like it's not quite where I want it to be. But and then you go to spring when you're ramping up truly and the urgency's there. And that's when you really know if it's a hurt or a, you know, thing you can work through. You just don't know until you're doing the daily grind of the game. And that unfortunately happens when spring training starts.
You know, it was surprising to me when John Means said he was a month behind, just because I wasn't sure what that meant. Like I know he's a starter and you relieved most of your career, but like, what does that mean to be a month behind? Like, what would you have been doing over the last month to get to this point? You know, like how, if opening day is 100%, what is February 16th and what is January 16th? Like, what's that month? You know, what percentages are you trying to get to?
Yeah, that's interesting because starters and relievers wildly different. Like I could throw four bullpens and go to spring and then I have enough time because of the way, like the level of endurance I need to have when the season starts. That's a luxury in a lot of ways. So it's easier to say you're a month behind when you're a starter because we think in the, you think in terms of like six like outing chunks or six bullpen chunks. So basically what he's saying is I threw six less. I'm six behind. Like I'm six in my progression. I'm six levels behind of where I would like to be going into a regular season. And with the whole thing with surgery and all that kind of stuff, like they're just naturally going to be slow because he didn't throw very much. So did he even throw at the end of last year? He did just a couple, I think. So he doesn't have a lot of innings. So they're still going to be tentative with him. And when it's a starter, like a month is kind of just the, like a one unit of time kind of when you're ramping. So it's just an easy round number to use. But yeah, he's probably like, I can only get stretched out. If I go now, I could probably get stretched out to three innings or, you know what I mean? Like only, you know, and that's not enough to start the season on the team, which is not. So, that's kind of the benchmark I think for him.
That would be your guess. If he's a month behind that, it's going to be hard to be there on opening day.
Exactly.
And I guess for them, the process, you're talking about a bullpen. If you're talking about six bullpens, you can do that in 2 weeks?
Yeah, like a reliever could do it in 2 weeks because I can throw like a 15 pitch, a 20 pitch, a 25 pitch, a 30 pitch, and then like two 30 pitches, and now I'm put me in a game.
And then you have to just port that over with more rest for a starter and more pitches. So they're going to go, it's 20 or 30 a couple times, try to get to 50. I mean, they have to get to 80 or 100. So
they have to at least get to like 75. They have to get to 75, 80 before this regular season starts. And that is minimum.
And more rest between their bullpens.
Exactly. Yeah. Especially with his injury. So like add that in too. So it's even slower if you're being safe.
Looking for an assist with your credit card, but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's the little birdie? Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms and restrictions apply.
And it's not just like injury information that comes out this time of year. You get a lot of the best shape of their life stories.
Manoah looks good.
Those are fun.
Manoah looks really good.
Manoah looks good. He does. It's Instagram friendly. And then you get guys like, there was a story from Martin Gallegos, covers the A's for MLB.com. Mason Miller lighting up the radar gun in his first bullpen session at HoHo Camp. And I'm thinking like, I don't necessarily want Mason Miller lighting up the radar gun in February. I want him to be healthy on opening day, and that's clearly the biggest priority for the organization, but are there just some guys that can't dial it back? Like, they're just always 100% sitting close to that max, and that's just the way their bodies work?
Yeah. Yeah, he's definitely one of those. Seeing that in person, he doesn't look like, I mean, he looks like he's putting something on it, like, in games. Like, that's not what you see in bullpens, but, like, nice and easy is the same thing. You know, it's maybe minus 3 miles an hour. And I've played with a lot of those guys that just, they don't care how hard they're throwing in the bullpen and they're still throwing harder than you. Like, and it's just the way, it's the mechanically they've figured something out, and the way that they deploy strength and like flexibility is like their mechanics. Like, it's part of their mechanics. They like have to do it at that level or the mechanics don't work. And so like DeGrom, we were talking before the show, he's a guy who, he just figured it out perfectly. He's so athletic that like being athletic is something he has to do to throw the ball. And if when he's athletic, he throws really hard. That's just like the way it is. He's a freak. But again, there's the other side of that coin where, you know, the body can only just do that so many times. Like it's just not built to throw a baseball overhand. It's just isn't. So, yeah, I don't, especially with Mason, I really don't think this is a, hey guys, look at me. Like, cause you know, we get it. You throw 102, like everyone knows, he knows, you know, like it's, so it's not a showing off thing. That
he's
does
just
happen,
trying to be ready,
but he's just trying to be ready. He's just trying to be like, hey, look, I'm healthy. And
yeah,
but yeah, it's,
did you ever
6 weeks? We need to be healthy.
what was your, was he ever your catch partner?
I never played catch with him. I was my catch partner was Austin Pruitt.
Okay.
My recommendation for anyone playing with Austin Pruitt is try to get him as your, that guy hits you in the center of the chest every throw.
Whoa.
Shout out to Austin. He's the best catch partner I ever had. Sorry to everybody else, but my, like, wow. It was, it made me feel good. It felt like we were getting something accomplished. But no, I never played catch with him. And I felt bad for the guys that did. Him and Louis Medina. Woof. Tough. Just because they throw so hard and they're just electric and they don't know how to throw soft. So
yeah, and Medina's, you know, does not always know where it's going.
No, there's a lot of there's one against the wall every time. That's Danny Jimenez's partner. Good luck.
That's incredible. The other thing I wanted to kind of bring up today was the general idea on this show. What we're gonna do is we're gonna start deep diving into each pitch, all the different pitches that could be in an arsenal, because you've thrown them, you've seen other people throw them up close. Eno studies it in depth, and we think there's a way to really inform and educate everybody, like, what makes pitches effective? Why are some pitches good when you watch them on TV, but they're actually very hittable, right? There's all sorts of different combinations that can play out as you sort of look at arsenals, and we're going to start with the basics. We're going to start with the four-seamer, and it's pretty wild because we've got a couple examples. So we're going to start with one that I think anybody watching the show can look at and say, this is a good four-seamer. This is a Felix Bautista four-seam fastball. 101, top of the strike zone, right?
Good
Everything
luck.
You could possibly want in a four-seamer. And for me, the thing that I think is a little bit misleading is it's not just the velo. There's more to that fastball than the triple digits. That's the thing that the average person is going to look at and say, yep, excellent fastball, 101. So I am curious, why is Felix Bautista's fastball even better than that radar gun reading is going to tell us?
You know, you want to start with this one? Because I have some stuff that I think I want to add to your stuff.
Okay, well, you know, it's the thing that fascinates me about this, and one of the reasons why I created Stuff Plus, is that I don't think it's always obvious to the human eye. Now, hitters will say, yeah, I can tell that pitch has ride, and ride is just the concept of the ball, because of its spin, doesn't drop as much as you'd expect. You can see it in a beach ball. If you throw a beach ball right with this right spin, it'll go up. You know, it'll actually go up. But because a baseball is thicker and harder and smaller and heavier, it won't go up like a beach ball, but that's the same effect. It's countering gravity, and it shows up at the plate higher than the batter expects. So a batter will know about this. But when we see pitches from behind like that Felix one, it's really hard to see. If you're in the ballpark anywhere other than right behind home plate in the scout's seats, I think it's really hard to see. I think even in the scout seats, I've sat in the scout seats, and I'm not always sure if that pitch had good ride or if it was just straight, you know?
Yeah.
And so that was why one of the reasons why I created Stuff Plus. And if you got here, this is a Stuff Plus interaction chart. And so this is maybe a lot, but really just focus on the red. So what you have on the y-axis is vertical movement, and what you have on the bottom is velocity. In the black, that's Felix Bautista. The red ones, that's good. So if you look at it, you can see, oh, velo is good. Yes, we knew that. Throwing 100, it doesn't almost matter what your vert is if you throw 100. So if you're worried about Paul Skeens, you know, throwing 100, 102, like, it won't matter if he throws that hard. But you can see how that red kind of just goes backwards. You know, vert is always good. You know, and it always makes you a little bit better than the people who don't have vert. And that's why we've been chasing vertical movement for so long as a sport. And that's why Felix Bautista's pitch is not only good from velo, as you can see, 99 on average, but also best vert in the league. And he's in that nice red where you want to be, not in the blue, which is, you know, the average fastball is in the blue. That's what every player sees. That's the average fastball. They're used to that. They're trained for that. You know, they're not trained for Felix Bautista.
Exactly. Yeah, it's all. So, yeah, when you're searching for vert, especially if you're a four seam guy, that is the vert is the premium. Like it's a benchmark. Do you have the ability to throw above average vertical break? And then the other factors kind of pile on, and then you can find kind of outliers that way, which we have a couple examples of that here in a moment too. The interesting for me is, and thing for me is, yeah, Felix Bautista is, you know, the perfect example because he has the IVB. And by the way, I realized that we had talked about this term, and I want to quickly pop it out there because I think that I'm going to be using it quite a few times on the show, and maybe I can give it just a quick definition. But that blue area is commonly known in baseball as a dead zone fastball, somewhere that is closer to what a hitter would expect. And it's closer to the average. So if you throw a sinker, you want to be below that dead zone. If you want to throw a four seam, you want to be above that dead zone in terms of vertical movement. That is usually the word everyone uses or the phrase. And then if you are in that dead zone, then velo is the way that you try to make up for that, which Eno mentioned earlier, that it doesn't matter as much when you throw really hard. A prime example of a guy like this is Fuji with the Mets now. So he is a prime example of a guy with not great vertical movement, but he throws so hard that he can get away with it in certain places pretty much every time. But one thing that's really interesting about Felix Bautista is the way that he throws. So there is the way the ball moves, and then there's perception of how it's going to move. That if you can change that perception a little bit, that is a deadly combo. So he also has the splitter, which is a whole nother can of worms, which we could talk about for, I'm sure, an entire hour, how that pairs with his fastball. But he's tall. So what is he, 6'8"? So he's very tall.
And he's over the top, right?
And he throws straight over the top. That's another common term for you. An iron Mike, an old pitching machine that used to just catapult the ball at you. Those are called iron Mike. So guys who throw directly over the top, 12 o'clock, we call them iron Mikes. And usually they have great backspin, which produces pretty good ride. So he's one of those. So he throws from literally like above everyone in the league's head, including Aaron Judge, like every single hitter, like it's coming down. So when you get this downward angle kind of perception, you think you have this based on how he throws, you think you're going to see some sort of downward trajectory, and then he has the highest ride. So then that doesn't happen. So like it compounds that effect that like, even how he throws makes it look like gravity's going to affect it even more. And it does the exact opposite. Now the barrel is moving even farther from the ball. So not only are people missing it, they're missing it by a lot. And then you add the splitter, it goes the opposite way underneath that where that barrel is. So I bet you hit, like if this were even measurable, I don't even know if you can. It'd be really interesting. But like the average distance the bat misses the ball by.
That was such a great thing you just said. Like, I feel like you could do that in a front office, but maybe not in public data.
Maybe the cameras don't have the high enough frame rate yet on Hawkeye. I don't know. I've been told they don't. So that is probably it. The technology is quite not there yet, but I bet you he has some of the worst swing and misses, at least on fastball splitter in the league as well. So like you expect something based on how he's coming at you. And he's big and intimidating already. And then he throws 100, and then it doesn't move the way you think it's gonna move. That makes that, you know, that's a guy who doesn't give up any runs ever. That's pretty much why he's so good. But he's basically checks all the boxes. The guys who are interesting are the guys that check some of the boxes and have a very interesting reaction because of that.
Well, there's also, as more and more ride is in the league, more, you know, batters are a little bit more in tune to that idea that, okay, here's an iron Mike, he's going to have ride. So there's, in a way, it's expected now in a pro hitter is going to stand in against Felix, see him throwing over the top like that and expect ride. So he doesn't care that you expect it. he's just going to be so good at it. He's obviously like the best in the league at it. So he's like, I know you expect it, but good luck anyway. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, there are other people, you know, where, you know, we have here, this is the best ride in baseball. And you can see this vertical movement category that has 20.5 for Felix Bautista. That's the type of language, and this is from Alex Chamberlain's, pitcher, what's it called? His pitcher pitch specs. I forget what he calls it, pitch leaderboard. So look up Alex Chamberlain. The reason I want to put this up is this is the language that the players speak. 20 vert is that's 20 IVB and that's an imputed vertical break. Like that is what induced vertical break. That's what people think of when they think of elite. They that's the language they speak. They speak 20s. So Felix Bautista has those 20s that people are chasing. But you can also see on this that it doesn't just getting to 20 doesn't mean you're amazing. You know, Trevor Richards is not, you know, wouldn't come up as one of the best pitchers in the league if you made a list. Colin Pache, you know, Jose Urquidy's on this list. So there's other things that come into factor. You know, if you are throwing super over the top like Nick Pivetta, you need to get to those 20s to make it work because people kind of, this is expected movement. So there's a little difference. Nestor Cortes is on this list and he's got a 5.9 foot vertical release point versus Felix Bautista's 7 foot. So when you step into the box against Nestor Cortes, you think, I don't know. This doesn't look like an Iron Mike. And then the pitch comes at you like an Iron Mike's. So there's this disconnect between what you expect and what you were given. We have another video here really quickly of Jose Urquidy's fastball. This is on the list of the top five in vertical break. I don't know. That looks like easy peasy. 92, you know, straight as a bean, and it does get hit. And I think part of that is he releases it like a foot shorter than Felix Bautista, so batters get to see it for a foot longer. His release point is not as extreme, and there's something about it that's more expected. So there is a relationship between what you do and what people expect you to do given your arm slot.
Yes, Jose is a prime example of a guy who is closer to what you expect, and there's not a lot of perception change there, and then there's also not high velo either. Like that was, you know, 92, you know, that's at, like below average now,
and minus 92 minus given the fact that he's releasing it short arm.
And,
so it's,
yeah, and it's slowing down a lot more by, you know, air resistance, all stuff. It's actually going slower than another person that has a longer extension throwing 92. It might be going a little bit faster. They're actually technically throwing harder. That's a we're not going to go there, but that's a whole thing.
Wait, did you have good extension?
Yes, I had very good extension. I think my lowest was 94th percentile in a year. So me and Edwin Diaz are the same, pretty much.
And so you, I was just interested in this too. Like you're training, you're a pitcher, you're training. You want vert, you want extension. Are any of those innate and like good luck trying to get it? Like you had extension. Did you as a kid want that? Or is it just did you jump? Are you like a jumper? You know, like did you kind of jump off the mound?
That's the
drop and drive.
Tom Seaver, so that Nolan Ryan.
And that was like from as a kid or is like coming up, they were like, we want more extension out of you. Like do this.
As a kid, that's how I perceive, that's how you threw hard. Like I learned, like, oh, you just got to push off as hard as you can and then throw as hard as you can. Like that's how I perceived it. Like Todd, I was Tom House had an extension kind of, you know, fad.
He likes the towel drill too, right?
Yeah, towel drill too. You want to reach out and you want to snap it against the glove. My dad would move farther out. We weren't really thinking about it as extension. It just worked that way in terms of like follow through or release or getting the ball out. That was very common, like in the early aughts when I was learning or late 90s. So you know, we checked the three-ring binder for the Tom House articles, blogs, and found the ping, and then we practiced. That's how I learned. So I was very much like that, but I don't think it's entirely necessary, but that is the benefit. Like if you do have ride, the funny thing about if you have ride and then you can get long extension, the interesting thing is then the perception of the ball is that it's going to go higher than it is. So you can get lots of called strikes at the top of the zone. And But if you change heights, so one thing for me, I'm 6'5". I'm a big dude and I stand up tall. So I stand up tall and I come set. So you see tall, big guy. Like I look like Felix Bautista at this point. And then I come up and they're like, okay, still nothing to tell me he's not going to be an Iron Mike. And then I get low. When I get low, they're like, okay, now he's way lower than I thought was possible. My relief point was like 5'6". So like my vertical release was 5'6". And then I threw up in the zone and I had like 17 to 18 ride mostly in my, which is good. It's above average. It's top, you know, top 20% in the league, but I could get so low. So I was tall. Expectation changes again when I go down and then I throw ride again. So then it's riding like a guy who like beat Bautista is tall. So they're going, he has ride. No, he doesn't. Yes, he does. Like that's the, that was my dynamic and that's happening subconsciously. And there's a bunch of guys that do that really, really well. And that actually explains why their ride works better than for, say, Jose Urquidy's, because they have something that there's doubt placed at some point in the delivery subconsciously. Like that is my theory. That is, I'm going to stand by this. Some point they change their mind and then change it back and it happens quick and it takes a while to get used to. And when you're facing a reliever, you're facing once and you're like, well, I don't have the time to figure this out. So then you get back and you're like, oh, this is happening again. And then it's over again. You're like, ah, so it takes months to get to a reliever. Starter's a little bit different, but,
Starter you get to see three times in a game and yeah.
Exactly. So that was interesting. And I know that worked for me really well, but it wasn't on purpose. It's very hard to teach, especially extension. Guys struggle to learn extension, especially as a pro.
Yeah, I think you've been throwing so long by the time you're in a pro. Mm-hmm. Like you're gonna tell them like you want me to do what now? You know, like I've been throwing this way for 10 years.
It's legs. So like you learn legs first.
Yeah.
So if you're trying to change how your legs work, it's gonna affect everything. So you have to break everything down. It's like, it's very hard to separate it. It's not a separate
thing. Almost like it only happens like post-surgery, I feel like. Sometimes post-surgery, people are like, okay, I'm going to start all over, you know?
But I need 18 months to relearn how to pitch. Yeah, that's definitely it.
How about chasing vert? Did you ever chase vert? Did you, like, I think the only thing I've really heard of is like a clean fuego, which is like a ball that doesn't have the rest of the ball. It's like the middle of the ball without the sides. And the only way that you can really throw it right is by throwing it with backspin, like sort of true backspin. It helps you with spin efficiency, turn it more of your spin into vert. Did you ever do a clean fuego? Did you ever do anything else to chase vert? Or was just you thought like this is the vert I've got and this is, I mean, you weren't able to really push it.
So clean fuegos are really interesting. There's guys like, here's a prime example of a guy that actually did a lot of work with the clean fuego. Luke Bard. He was a, you know, spin rate darling, like 3,200 spin rate on his fastball led the league. But he had what we call wobble, like his ball just like changed its axis constantly. And for whatever reason, like arm path, whatever, they're trying to figure it out. And then throwing clean fuego, what you want to do is you hold it on a four seam and you throw it. And it's got like, it's like a flat ball. So it's flat on the sides and it's round normally like a ball. You're holding like a disc. You're throwing it and you want it to cut just slightly when you're playing catch. And be true. So if it's spinning true back, it goes, just cuts a little bit like towards your glove side. And so,
but you can also see like you see the wobble or not, right?
Yeah. So if it's wobbling, it's going whoa, 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 and it won't cut. Like it's very obvious. It makes it very, very obvious. Guys used to do this with like, they draw on the ball and they try to get the line.
Yeah, you can draw on the ball too. Yeah.
And they couldn't get the line, but then there was no like physical, it wasn't so obvious. So it's really hard to see. So this was developed. I picked up a fuego, I threw it and it just perfectly cut every time. So I was like,
this is not going to help me.
This is naturally. So this is guys who are like, don't have a lot or they're in the dead zone. They're just trying to get slightly above it. They're trying to add some efficiency. And I already kind of naturally had that. So what actually helped me develop, like make sure my ride was consistent and that I was getting it regularly was during my long toss. So a lot of people talk like pull downs and all this, like building arm strength, the velo. Yes, that all works. But when I played long toss, I could see ball trajectory really,
long toss
really well.
Is hugely important.
Huge.
And not only for arm strength, but for what you're talking about, movement. You can really, because the movement, you have so much longer for the movement to develop. You can just see, you can see it.
Exactly. You can physically see it. You're like, you can see now numbers that you saw on the track, man. You can see them. You're starting to realize like what you're seeing and then what that translates in.
What does ride look like in long toss? Does it just sort of like float up and then fall down or something?
Kind of, yeah. Or like, what was it the other day? There was a Japanese player who threw the ball home, and remember the guy catches it perfectly, and it was like, whoa! Like, it went viral for a while. That ball had so much ride that it didn't die. So it just keeps, it feels like it's just going to keep going if you're not there. Like I'd have guys catch low throws I throw. Like if I do a pull down when I'm coming in, like at like 180 feet and they go low, like it's going to hit the ground and then it doesn't. So like they get kind of a little bit locked up because they're they got caught by the right because low in the zone too. I could get guys frozen there because they're assuming it's going to be below the zone.
They think it's going to go below. Yeah,
exactly. So guys who catch it like that, like, dude, what was that? So it seems harder too. So that's kind of like when I saw that reaction, that is when I was like, okay, I am spinning this thing and it's catching the way that I wanted to catch. But if I don't have it, I start to get this fade. I see my partner start to move over a lot and I'm on the side a little bit. I'm getting this like weird.
Right. So you're turning too much of your spin into sideways movement, whereas you want it to be kind of true.
And that's when I know I got to like focus on it more.
And so you'll see on that leaderboard, a lot of these guys have minus horizontal movement. They're turning so much of their spin into like, if you look at look at Colin Pache's four seam, that has very little horizontal movement. Nick Pivetta's is very little. What do you see when you see it's more two plane? Like how is somebody getting on here for vert and also having like Bobby Miller? I don't know if you've ever seen Bobby Miller's four seam, but it has a two plane movement where how do you do a two plane? Like what is going on? Do you just have so much spin?
Yeah, I think it's spin related. There's a lot of spin related there. And the interesting thing really quickly, a note about Pache, lefties and righties. So lefties will be positive horizontal if it's a running arm side a little bit, and then lefties will be negative. So Pache actually has cut. Like he's throwing cutters.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, yeah. I forgot to make that adjustment in my head. Yeah.
And also zero isn't perfect backspin either.
Zero is kind of cut.
Zero is like cut for both sides. So like what is it? Righties is like 5-3. -5-3 is like a true, with everything kind of factored in, that's a true backspin four seam almost perfectly.
Because, straight. And this is partially because I think no matter what pitch you throw, you do pronate.
Yeah, you have to. You can't throw a ball without it. Yeah.
Yeah, your arm will pronate. And pronating is, if you're watching on YouTube, pronating is movement like, let me see.
Turning your hand outwards away from your body. When you finish. So at some point you're turning your hand like this, and where the ball's released in that turn dictates how it moves.
Yeah. And so since you do that, there's going to be some component of sideways spin, right? Like you can't throw a ball like this. Like you can't physically just take a ball and go like this and make everything, you know, perfectly, you know, that just like your body won't do that. So yes. And the sort of, no matter what, you're going to have a little bit of sideways movement, and that's so zero is not true zero. It's actually cutting a little bit. And
exactly.
Yeah. In Pache's case. Yeah. The distinction between IBB leaderboards and vertical movement ranking on Baseball Savant is annoying as poop to me. I wish that everyone had gotten together and said, like, this is what we'll do. And it seems like baseball did one thing, and then all the sites that were publicly out there did something else. Mm. And it's really annoying. You can't port over 20 when you hear pitchers talking about vert or IBB, you can't port that over to Baseball Savant. The only way that I think that you can use Baseball Savant to play along is to actually use the relative movement. So I would ignore the gross movement because I don't even really have a great sense of what that means. But you can see, if you look at Felix Bautista's page on Baseball Savant, you'll see a nice big red +3 or something. And that's basically saying his vertical movement is 3 inches better than league average. And that's good enough. That's your best way to play along on Baseball Savant.
Exactly. Those numbers are also attached to people. There's a certain range of velos that's attached to as well. So like guys with that, his vert, it's like vert who, it's vert amongst dudes who throw 99 too, and which there are a lot.
Which makes sense because if you throw slower, you have more time to move. Yeah. So there's a relationship between time and distance and movement and spin and velo. You know,
I do have a little rule of thumb though. I used to look at Savant a lot before I was using True Media or even like other things. 20 is kind of the benchmark. That is what TrackMan talks in. That is what Rapsodo talks in. But a quick dirty kind of conversion. A guy that's like a 10 vert. So basically induced vertical movement is like the perception, perception score. It's got weights and stuff in it. And then the other one is kind of like a, how much is it dropping?
That's Savant. Savant is like, how much is it dropping? So a lower number is better.
Yeah, lower number.
If you do want to look at raw, lower number is better. Yeah.
So if you got a guy in the nines, like on Savant, he's 20s plus every time. Yeah. Strider's flirting with that. I had 1 year in like 16. I think this was because the technology sucked, but I was like 9.7, which was like crazy because I never got near that again. Another good one is Liam Hendricks. Go check his out. He's got some of the best true backspin or has in the past as well in terms of that. And again, it ranks them. So like you see a guy with a bright red number and it's like those numbers, the numbers light up because of percentiles in the league. Similarly to when you took the test when you were in elementary school and they said what percentile you were in as opposed to getting your grade. Yeah. That is what they go by. So like bright red's like top 5%, fifth percentile in the league for that type of thing. And so if a guy's got a bunch of reds, like on all of his pitches, his stuff's moving really good comparatively. I just go, how much red is there here? And then I go from there when I'm looking at a guy.
And to be fair, Strider's a really interesting name that you brought up. To be fair to Savant, I think the reason they did it is their vertical movement number has some kind of adjustment, some sort of knowledge of the release point, you know? And I think that vert movement, like in terms of IVB, like it's at least vert movement on Alex Chamberlain's thing, like a 20 is a 20, and it doesn't really take into account your release point in the same way.
Exactly.
So Strider having a 9, Strider does not show up here in vert move at the top. And so, you know, that speaks a little bit to what we were talking about is the relationship between your release point, what people expect. Strider is low, you know, he's doing what you were talking about doing. And he totally did it on purpose and he did it post-surgery. He said, I want to have a low release point with as much ride as possible from high extension. He was like, that's what I want to do. I want to have these three things because he's an analytical mind that like knew that from a stuff plus based research from what we've looked at, that that's going to be effective. So coming out of TJ, he was like, I'm going to drop, you know, I'm going to stand tall and then I'm going to drop and then I'm going to release way out in front and I'm going to try to have ride on it and play around with people's perceptions of what's going to happen. So in some ways, like Baseball Savant can be superior in sort of grouping how hitters perceive that,
exactly.
You know, so Strider having a 9 there and having, I don't know, like a 17 vert over here, the 9 on Baseball Savant tells the story better in a way.
Yeah.
And another reason why I did stuff plus elite is because it kind of pulls, you know, it pulls all these things together, you know, and I hate that it's a black box and it's doing this in all these different ways, looking at, oh, this release point's important here, extension's important here, and trying to put it all together. But each of the metrics we have otherwise can come short somewhere. So like vert move has some shortcomings. IVB has some shortcomings. Baseball Savants has some shortcomings. They each have their strength. The reason why I like the 20 language, the IVB sort of vert move language, is just because it's so ubiquitous in baseball. It's the Rapsodo TrackMan language. It's what I hear when I talk to players, you know.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10. Place your first bet on any game and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
And you were talking about the difficulty of adding extension before. I was just looking at Mike Soroka's page again because he had a couple Achilles injuries, missed a lot of time. Is the Savant extension data useful for people who want to play along publicly? Because he actually increased extension a lot after a two-year gap, and I'm wondering how much that may have just been being down with an injury and having a chance to rebuild the mechanics a lot more.
I bet it was, yeah.
Yeah, it has a lot to do with that. I didn't know about the extension increase, but he talked a lot about throwing more four seams this last year, and so I'm like, what other pitchers have you been just having long conversations with? I bet you Spencer Strider's one. Soroka was
a sinker guy.
Shorter extension and heavy sinker. Like those things kind of tend to go together too. Because you're giving the ball longer time to move as well. So it gets that heavier feel. Guys, like they say it's like hitting a bowling ball. Or anyone who's tried to hit like a heavy softball or something with like a metal bat, like it's like it sucks. Or like something that's not supposed to be hit, like a basketball, right? Yeah, so like it's jarring, and that's what you want. And so going the other way is usually very hard because those two things are poor. You need the extension and the sink you need the extension and the ride. So like you have to learn two things to get that effect well. And he might not, again, because he struggled a little bit with getting away with those four seams, and there were growing pains where he was getting hit a lot harder than he's ever been hit. And that's part of what comes along with being a four seam like breaking ball guy, is when you do get hit, you give up harder contact because of the nature of the pitches. You're relying on almost lack of movement than you are movement. And so giving up barrels is like homers are usually an issue. Strider, that's his
Strider
problem. Yeah. DeGrom, the same. Like he just only runs he ever gave up were homers. So it's like you just got to be okay with that. So that's an interesting. He's a great example, an interesting change. I'd love to see like what a full year of like being healthy and fully working on it. Like if he continues to kind of be able to have both those things in his arsenal, if that becomes a weapon as opposed to something he was still trying to learn.
Really clear runway.
Statistically, I would say that like extension's pretty the same everywhere. I think.
Yeah.
There's only a question of, you know, where you measure things from. But, you know, now that we have eyes on it, basically, Hawkeye is a visual thing. Like, it's just going to look at where you release the ball and measure it. So, I'd say the extension is pretty standardized. Yeah.
Yeah. For sure. If anyone's got questions, feel free. Throw them in the chat. We can answer a few. This is the biggest question of the day. Why is DVR wearing a collared shirt? I'm not. It's a long sleeve. I just threw it on because I'm cold. I would never wear a collared shirt. No live stream.
I mean, it's
Wisconsin.
Midwest Wisconsin is the answer.
It's just cold here. Perry, excited about the addition of Trevor on Fridays. We are too. It's awesome.
Trevor, I've got a question for you.
Yeah.
You threw a two seam along with your four seam. My impression is if you throw a pretty good four seam with ride and you throw a two seam, the idea is just to differentiate it sort of horizontally. So it's more of a two seam rather than a sinker.
Yeah, there's a lot of guys that call them sinkers. They're not. Actually, it's becoming very popular to throw the high, kind of heavy horizontal two-seam as a wrinkle. We're going to see a lot more of that this year, I think, especially like right on right, up and in. Because hitting that up and in spot's very, very hard to do consistently, and guys struggle with it. Like guys who throw straight four-seams, like trusting that you're not just going to sail one into their armpit. Like that was the thing I struggled with, like really getting throwing strikes in there. But if you can do it, nobody handles up and in well for juice consistently. They have to be looking for it. It's like a hole that pretty much every right-hander will have.
Well, and then even the ones that don't have it, like Correa and Bregman and like the high and tight hitters, Paredes, some of those guys, Soler, the guys that do that, they want a four seam there.
Yeah, they want a four seam.
They're looking for four seam high and tight. And if you give them a two seam high and tight, they're likely to foul it off. I think foul most likely, even if they're ready for it and that's what they like, you know, because the movement is not going to be right on their barrel.
Exactly. So yeah, that wrinkle pitch will get. It's becoming like a variation thing. So expect the Dodgers and the Rays and the Astros. Like, just expect that. You'd see a lot of it.
Two or three kinds of hard pitches high.
Yeah, yeah. Especially relievers. Relievers are mixing them in once or twice and just being like, yeah, I have that. And you don't have to really be that fine. You just aim up, and then usually it just naturally goes over there. And you can miss. It doesn't need to be a strike, and it's just saying, hey, I have it. And like, it's just getting more and more popular because the four seams, like you said, there's people, guys are training to get on top of it, blocking that ball off. That's what it's called. They're calling it blocking, getting the foot down and getting the barrel to the high pitch. And so you have to, pitchers got to adjust, and then it'll flip back again. So that's kind of what's going to happen. That is definitely something that was mentioned a lot at the end of last year, and I think it's going to be very popular this year.
Here's a question from Hayden on the live stream. What's the single best pitch in baseball right now?
Oh, what do you think, Hino?
I'll submit Devin Williams' changeup, airbender, as one, just purely by unique nature.
Of course.
Hey, you know what? I got to wear this shirt to stay warm. I'm going to at least prop him up a little bit.
I mean, I don't think anyone's been able to replicate it. A lot of people tried. I feel like that's the pitch that is just kind of really, really defied pitch design so far. Guys are like, actually, let's just learn splitters. Try to get that effect because no one can like pronate like that. He throws a slider that way. It goes that way. It's just, yeah, people physically
twist
can't do
over.
It.
It's like, it's crazy. It looks like it would hurt.
Slow motion out of his fingers. I'm like, I don't know how that's, how can you feel that and like be comfortable with it? He's throwing it like with his pinky. And I can't imagine that. I can't even move my pinky independently of my other fingers. How does he even do that? I don't know. Crazy. Some people are like that.
We updated Stuff Plus. So I've got an answer from that perspective. Aroldis Chapman's sinker?
Nope. No, come on.
Felix Bautista's split finger?
No way.
Okay. That's at least, that makes sense.
Robert Stevenson's cutter, Tyler Glasnow's curveball, Ryan Pressly's slider, and Matt Brash's slider.
Okay, so I was going to ask about Brash, but like, okay, so we're talking Pressly's slider cutter thing or his curveball?
Yeah.
Like his hard curveball because he throws, you know, low 80s.
I know.
They're both very good.
I got Pressly curveball 140 Stuff Plus and Pressly slider 170. So it's the harder one.
Oh wow. That's his bulk pitch. I wonder if you ask him, he'd be like, no, that's like my fastball. That's what I throw at my fastball.
When I asked a bunch of players, and even a couple guys in the A's locker room said Matt Brash's slider.
Oh, everybody loves Matt Brash's slider. He might actually win in the worst swings category.
That's true.
I've never seen Jose Ramirez fall down in my career or even miss a pitch, frankly. I don't think I've ever gotten him swing and miss, maybe once. And I was like, oh, it's like that, huh? Yeah, Brash and sliders, fun to watch.
A lot of pitching ninja goodness from Brash.
Oh, yeah. Great eyebrows, too, Matt Brash.
Alex wants to know, do you know which batter you struck out the most in your career?
Eugenio Suarez, I believe 8 or 9 times.
Is this from memory or are you a baseball referencing yourself?
No, I know that from memory. He passed Napoli last year. Nap takes the cake. I love him, man. I was a huge fan of Mike Napoli. Loved the way he played.
Nap Wiener.
But man, I owned him. I really did own him. I think he'd tell you that.
What do you think it was?
I don't know, man. Maybe it was because it was early in the ride game. Like I was like 18 was his last year. So like we had just learned what it was and I had it the whole time. And I was throwing, and I had just bought into throwing high heaters. And he was 0-for-7.
And they were probably, low swings trying to murder sinkers.
He's a very good low ball hitter. And he started to get that high block off swing, but he'd swing at it every time. And he's just like, oh, towards the end, you could tell he was like, I don't know why. I don't know. I don't know what it is about this guy. I just can't do it.
It looks good until it's above the bat.
It looks good until it's, I froze him a bunch of times too, which is weird. It's something I never do. I don't know. He was just my guy that it always worked out for. It just happened. Mm. I think I froze him like 3 times. I probably froze like 8 guys in my whole career.
But you remember all those. I mean, how many of the batters you faced in your career, but how many at bats do you remember? What percentage of them do you think? Like most of them?
I would say more than half, yeah. I'd say if you recall I could tell you like day or night game for the most part. And then that would like tell me like what time of the year, like I could generally, I don't know. You just do a lot of like, when you get really like nervous or anxious about a game and like you're super prepping for it. So you make sure it's like prepping for a test. You're like, I got to make sure. And then you like, you remember stuff from those tests you took in high school that you crammed for because you hammered it into your psyche. And that's very much how I approach the game of baseball. So that it's such an intense emotion. You're very, very much in like getting ready to pitch to a guy. So you're going to remember the AB against him. I'll never forget the Aaron Judge September 11th AB ever. I mean, it also was a homer and they tied the game and stuff like that. That all has a lot to do.
And it sucked, but
but the anticipation for that AB, well, I remember anticipating it for 3 days. I like, knew it was going to happen. I'm like, I'm going to face Aaron Judge
with the game,
on the line on September 11th, playing the Yankees in Citi Field. Like, it's going to happen. And it did exactly. And then he hit the homer second pitch.
You know, from I was a psychology major. From a psychology perspective, the more motion and adrenaline you have, the more you remember. Yeah. An event. So I would assume that most of the time when you're on a major league mound, even though it sounds like a lot, 2000 or whatever, like those are adrenaline filled moments for you. You're always like pitching for your life, pitching for next year, pitching for your contract, no matter what year you are, what time it is. When you walked into the A's clubhouse for the first time, did you immediately know who you'd face?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. Well, there wasn't many, but I remember
Rook.
I never faced Rook. I think it was Peterson. I remember strikeout. He's like, do you remember your strikeout of me last year? I'm like, yeah. It was a big AB. Guys were on second and third. Because I remember I even like gave a yell and stuff, and it was like a 97. He goes, I was like, yeah, 97 up and away for forcing fastball. He's like, hey, blow my doors off. Cause he was, and then I'm like, yeah, I struck out Colton Wong earlier in a high changeup. And so you were like, changeup might come here. He's like, yes, I was thinking that. I'm like, I know, I was right.
That's why I threw that other one.
He's like, Jesus, you remember all this? I'm like, yeah, because that was what we, you know, I just
my job.
Injury. Like, I needed that. We needed that. We needed to win the game. I remember, like, it was a big game. Like, we're chasing the Braves, like, or trying to stay ahead of them. Like, so he's like, dude, I'm like, and then we also were talking about the anxiety stuff. I'm like, it's pretty clear that baseball's pretty life and death for me too. He's like, that makes sense. That makes sense.
Market 8 dude on the stream. Did you ever know a pitch was going to be really good or bad as soon as it left your hand? The Judge one you just talked about?
Yeah. No, the Judge one, I'm like, oh, that's a bad pitch, but he can't even hit it. It was a changeup up and in. I have no idea. He just was like, yeah, no, he was just Aaron Judge. yeah, he's really good. Yeah. That pitch was bad. There was a curveball I threw to Devers, or slider I threw to Devers. I was like, oh, get down and in, please just get there. And he just like,
it didn't get there.
Pesky pulled me. It was a homer. It would have been a homer anywhere, but he wrapped it. And I was like, and I had to catch someone else's runs. It sucked. But that one, it came out of my hand. I was like, no. I actually have had this conversation with Ottavino a lot because he's a big guy on aborting pitches. I don't know if you, I've heard him talk about that, but like in the middle,
just like throwing it into the ground or something, or what?
In the middle of his delivery, he'd be like, okay, I'm gonna go slider here. And as he's throwing, he's like, no, and I'll just yank it. So he has some of the pitches where he threw it like off the camera, like it literally
was on purpose. He's just trying to get rid of the pitch.
He's like, there's been a couple. He has a couple of those are just misfires, like because his stuff is so much, right? And he's kind of,
I love Ottavino,
but every once in a while, he's like, every once in a while, just like, threw the worst pitch you've ever seen. And it was because I was like, no, he's gonna hit it. Like, and we just could be it in the middle of the pitch. It happens, we're human. But I do that too sometimes where I'll be like, yes. I'm like, why did I say yes?
In the last millisecond, getting some kind of cue and just saying, nope, bad idea.
And then you go into pet box mode, like, you got this. Just, you know, live with it. Live with whatever you're having this conversation.
The catcher called it.
You got it. You're going to kill him if you don't throw it. So that does happen sometimes. Yeah. But that Judge one was one. I was like, and then I'm like, I've seen this in my mind's eye already. And then it happened.
One more for today. This one's from Benjamin. Which hitter had the most impressive ability to identify and adjust to challenging pitches?
Oh, in my career, Miggy Cabrera. Far and away. That guy. And he was okay with it. He was okay with like getting nasty pitches. He was never worried about a guy who was too nasty. Because first of all, he had all this confidence and he's Mickey. He's just like his personality. Like he's just, that guy was never in doubt of how good he was. And even towards the end, he's still having a lot of fun. So he was okay with giving you the thumbs up if he got him. So once you did that, like he would just, he'd go like slider's coming, throw a fastball. And he'd be so good at just like hitting it into your dugout. And then just like, okay, try it again. You're like, I'm not confident I could throw that. Even that was by him. He was not looking for that. And it's still, he's still not out. So now I have to do it again. And he was a master at that, which is why he's a first ballot easy. He's amazing. But yeah, I just watching him, that's when I knew, I was like, oh, I'm in the show. Like you can't just like stuff a guy, like just give him your best stuff and like get him. And
that's it.
You got one and then now you got to get clever. And then they had him and V-Mart, who was another very, very good at that too. So just spoiling pitches, but yeah, Mickey Cabrera best, spoiling pitches. Then I'd say Votto early in his career was really good at it too. He was okay with it. Like just like chopping a ball, like foul and then getting another one to see. So, and then it was kind of sad to see as they got older, cause they're trying to do it and it was just slowing down. So it's harder to do. Yeah, I'd never seen anything like that. That's he was my welcome kid guy. It was impressive.
I think V-Mart, you kind of mentioned him there. He's one of those players that 10 more years are going to pass and people are going to realize how good he was. Like there's players like that in every era. And he's just underrated in terms of just overall ability to hit.
He didn't strike out looking for 2 years.
Wow.
It's insane. In this modern era.
Never see it again.
No.
I'll never see it again.
Not for a guy that can do damage like that anyway. If you see someone do it, it's not going to be anyone has any power. Kwan,
right? Yeah. Yeah. It's going to be Steve Kwan. Yeah. Yeah. No, Steve Kwan just won't strike out at all. Either way.
He's just getting rid of it completely. Tons of great questions today. We appreciate everybody who watched us live. We are going to call it a show. You can give us a follow on Twitter. Trevor is at I am Trevor May. Eno is at Eno Saris. I'm at Derek Wright. For the pod is at Rates and Barrels. Join our Discord. The link for that will be in the show description if you're listening to this podcast. Drop us a nice rating review. Smash the like button here. And Eno's got something here for us, too.
We're going to be in New York City live. The three of us doing two live podcasts at Other Half, March 2021 for the Soul Games. And so you can do some Q&A then, too. Please join us. We'll have some guests. We'll have a special beer and a special sandwich, as usual. And throw the Soul Games up on the background. So please visit us. And thanks for listening.